Thank you.
Life of the Average Cuban revolves around his little book, which allots the monthly food ration. And talk about a love-hate relationship. How well is that system working?
It is a successful part of a social safety net that does exist in Cuba. There is a ration of food. As one of the biggest opposition figures in Cuba said to me, this is not Haiti, this is not Sudan, people are not falling over dead. Mm-hmm. And the reason is we have a basic ration of rice, beans, sugar, and bread. Just enough to keep people alive. But it's the Cuban system that makes that ration necessary in a way because people are trapped, they can't take care of themselves, they can't even grow watermelons. One third of all food in Cuba now comes from the United States. And indeed, 70% of all food in Cuba is imported. And this in one of the most fertile islands in the world. This is just a giant cane field. You know, it's got 10-foot deep soil. You could spit a watermelon seed on the ground to get watermelons.
Well, I'm certainly getting a good sense of the Cuban frustration with that system. What do you get for this food ration?
The main ingredient is rice. The first pound of rice is 1 penny. So it's very heavily subsidized. Then you get another 4 pounds at about 4 cents a piece. The problem is you can't get more rice than that. It's in short supply. They're buying it abroad, and you get a little roll every day. The amount of beans has been cut back. That used to be a staple. And, of course, we all imagine Cubans eating rice and beans. But, in fact, you get about 1/2 pound of beans a month now, and that's nothing for Cubans. They'll go through that in a couple of days. There's almost no meat.
But there is some meat. There is some protein, right? What are we talking, beef, pork?
You get a what's called a protein. It's often a mystery what it is. I had chicken, supposedly chicken cutlets that in fact were, as the ingredients on them listed, mostly soy and wheat paste with some chicken flavoring, which I couldn't detect, 180 calories apiece.
So if you can't get enough of what you need from the government, you're going to have to get it somewhere else. Where do people get it?
Well, they get it from abroad, from family in Miami or Toronto or Madrid or Mexico. If you're a waiter, you have access in a hotel or something, you have access to tips. But the black market is really the big story, and that's where life is for most Cubans. There's a huge amount of theft. The state controls and owns all resources, and people basically loot it. Go to someone's house, and they cook a dinner, and you ask them, there's ground chicken on the plate. Where did that come from? Oh, my neighbor stole it from the cafeteria where she works. You know, I stole some gasoline from my job as a driver, and I traded her a liter of gasoline for 1.5 pounds of chicken. There is also a set of state markets, the agros, which are sometimes described as farmers markets, but they're not really. They're just sort of more expensive stuff that's not available on the ration, like peas and potatoes and things like that, is available for slightly higher prices. It's kind of that's how I shop.
And give me the concrete example of how you got stuck into the call it the underground economy, because you had an offloading experience that cemented that deal, right?
I had a previous contact there, a friend of a friend, and I went around to visit him. And we were all talking about the fact that everybody steals everything to survive. And suddenly there's this squealing brake sound, and a truck pulls up in front of his house. And he says, oh, quick, they're here. Go. And we all run to the front door, throw open the front door. And it was this big Cuban truck, and on the truck is some bags of cement. And they carefully parked it right against the door of his house and lowered the side of the truck facing the door while keeping the other sides up so nobody could see us as we hurriedly unloaded, I think it was 540 pounds of cement, and he stuffs a few bills in the hands of the driver. They close up the truck and go screaming off. Five of us working did all this in, I think, 90 seconds. Another example is just the ration store itself that exists in every neighborhood. That's where you're supposed to go get your food, but they never have a lot of the stuff. Well, guess where it is? It's for sale behind the ration store by the same people because they themselves have to make a living. So there was no coffee available anywhere. I'm dying. And I kept asking, you know, and finally I said, doesn't somebody have some coffee somewhere? And the guy sort of made this head-bobbing gesture, you know, wiggling his ears, which is Cuban for, well, it could be true. Who would that be? And he named some woman I've never heard of. And I said, well, where does she live? So he takes me out front. We step around the side of the building. We go behind the building, and we knock on a door. A woman answers, and he says, coffee. And she hands out the coffee. I hand in 3 times the official price, and I get my satchel of coffee, and, you know, this is their deal.
You even managed to scrounge a meal off one of Cuba's most prominent dissidents, who takes the view that food ration amounts to a kind of domination. What's he getting at?
The dissident in question said to me, it's not a supply system, it's a control system. It's a mechanism. Everybody in Cuba has to hew to the state. 95 to 99% of adult Cubans are state employees. Until recently, only half of 1% of working Cubans were self-employed, you know, just fixing bicycle tires and things. So, you know, you have to be on this ration book. You have to be in your official address. You can't survive without it. And it becomes, you know, just another way of sort of keeping everyone in Cuba waiting in the right lines where they can be watched.
Not everybody's in the same leaky boat. Some are in big yachts and grand houses. And I wonder, how does that go over with the average Cuban?
Cubans are obsessed with the notion now that there is corruption and that there are privileges. They never tolerated corruption. Now that's appearing for the first time at a high financial level because there are so many foreign corporations operating in Cuba. That means big money. So this has created a lot of opportunities for sticky fingers. And for the first time, there are reported to be a sort of invisible class of relatively young, high revolutionary people, often the children or grandchildren, especially of well-known revolutionaries and loyalists. So it is creating for the first time the sense that maybe we're not all in this together. And that's going to be a very dangerous realization for the Cuban government.
At one point, your wife sends you a shoebox full of cookies, right, which you cleverly ration. But what you did with the box itself afterwards is one sorry image. Tell everybody what you wound up doing.
I got this nice box of cookies. It was so great. I think I had 10 cookies. I was so hungry. The next day, I had 5 cookies and then 3 cookies and 2 cookies. And finally, at the end, I cut open the box along the edges with a knife so that I could get the last crumbs out of the bottom of the box because you can't afford in Cuba to not eat those crumbs. You have to go to the bottom of the box. You have to get every single grain of rice off the floor if you spill. And I think Cuban life, for me in those 30 days, as it is for Cubans in every 30 days, is about constantly being stressed and fearful over not knowing where, you know, you're going to get the fourth week's worth of food and money.
I'm going to frame this question as delicately as I can, but there's really no easy way to ask it. You're the only guy I've ever heard of who managed to get a hooker to give him money.
Yes,
but
I know.
She turns out to be a perfect example of the multitasking of Cuba's underground economy. How did that work?
She was a gal who I kept meeting. She used the same ration store. I ended up probably talking to her 4 or 5 times, fending off her propositions. And she told me her story. She was a nurse from Eastern Cuba, and she had a child. She told me, you know, I have a 2-year-old, and I love her very much, so that's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm a prostitute. Best paid people in Cuba are doctors, and they get $30 a month. Their national average salary is $18 a month. The line I heard again and again from Cubans is everyone must have an extra, and it could be your relative abroad. It could be your job in tourism. It could be prostitution, but it's a tragic thing to be in that situation. And she kept thinking I was going to be her meal ticket, so to speak, you know, and I was down to like a dollar at that point. And she finally accepted that this was true, that I had nothing to eat. And she could see me losing weight over the course of the weeks. And she started giving me, she gave me a little coin, which ended up being the last coin I had in Cuba and the one I took and used on the bus to out to the neighborhood where the airport is.
If the rations are barely adequate, why doesn't Cuba have a higher rate of malnutrition?
It's interesting. You know, I think the reason the revolution has survived is because it does fulfill us the most basic social commitment, which is to look after the elderly and the young. So on the ration system, there is milk and yogurt only until you are 7 years old. So they assure that although they have almost no milk and yogurt, it goes to the vulnerable. It goes to the kids who are developing, who need fatty acids in their diet in order to have a brain development that's on course. And Cuba is the only country in Latin America where the incidence of severe childhood malnutrition is 0.0%.
Is that right?
Up to the age of 7. Then you do, you know, your ration book says, oh, look, you turn 7. Sorry, no more yogurt, no more milk. And people do not see yogurt or milk again until they turn 65.
In reflection, how difficult do you think it would be to effect change of some kind, any kind, that would better feed the Cuban population?
I think it would be incredibly simple. It's virtually illegal now to grow a carrot in your backyard. Why? Why can't people grow food in their backyards? Why can't people start small businesses. It's illegal for Cubans to hire another Cuban, even one. So no business can, the few types of self-employment that are allowed, you can't open a shop and do that. It just has to be you sitting on a chair cleaning watches or fixing flat tires or something. There's already an example of that because they do allow these cooperative gardens in some places, in some cases. It's actually a very restricted system.
So even under Raul, and I guess with Fidel as well, who now appears astonishingly to be back, you think that there is reason to believe there can be some change under the Castro brothers?
It's fascinating. If you'd asked me a few weeks ago, I would have said no. But now even Raul Castro is talking about, you know, not just the fact that the government's going to lay off 500,000 or even a million workers, but that it must therefore allow them to go out and make jobs for themselves because the government doesn't have jobs for them. It's laying them off. This is a massive psychological break in the history of the revolution. If Raul Castro can introduce such ideas with Fidel Castro still alive and sort of not just alive but in for late innings, you know, he's like, I thought he was down, but suddenly he's in throwing curveballs again.
Exactly.
And it's got a much better chance of taking root, of being legitimate, and of starting a transition process if it's done through their hands with the, you know, revolutionary imprimatur rather than as being seen as something introduced from outside in a crisis. I think they need to make these start doing some kind of change on their own terms.
This is what you're learning as you're walking around Cuba living on a Cuban's survival diet. But I meant to ask you, how are you? How are you feeling during all of this? What's your body telling you?
My body reacted very suddenly and sharply. In many ways, the worst day for me out of the whole month was day three, because I was so used to eating what I wanted and to suddenly have this massive fall off in the amount of food available to me. Just left me, you know, starving. I was wandering through the streets looking for a sandwich. I ended up stealing a sandwich from a hotel that I wandered into. I don't mean to laugh that off. I'm ashamed of myself for getting to this point. But when you're hungry, you know what? You run out of options. My body adjusted very quickly. In a week, I was less pained and less hungry and starving all the time, you know. By the third week, I was kind of, you know, relaxed and used to it and just sort of eating my rice and beans. And, you know, the last few days in Cuba, I had like a sweet potato and a little rice for like the last 2.5 days.
That's it.
And, you know, I had, you know, when I went to the airport, I was very weak. I was walking to the airport because I couldn't afford a taxi. And I started feeling sort of dizzy because I hadn't had anything to eat in like 24 hours. But I walked along fine and I made it out of the country start to finish on 15 U.S. dollars.
And what have you lost or gained with respect to the system Cubans live under?
Well, I lost 11.5 pounds, and I gained an understanding of how creative Cubans are and also how stressed and how much of life is occupied with this basic material struggle. It keeps people busy. It's a country where survival is a great drama and art, backstopped by this kind of curious ration system.
Well, thank you very much, Patrick, for telling me about it. Your piece is a great read.
Thank you, Rick.